From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we discuss the state of play in Afghanistan. After 20 years of battling successive Afghan governments since their ouster in 2001 by a U.S.-led coalition, the Taliban returned to power 20 years later in August 2021. We feature two guests who will address many aspects of life under the Taliban, a predominantly Pashtun fundamentalist Islamist political movement which continues many of the harsh policies against minorities, women and girls that characterized their reign from 1996 to 2001. Most Western powers have declined to recognize the Taliban regime and have refrained from channeling aid through the government, which has reportedly lost about 80% of its funding. To the chagrin of many countries, including Muslim-majority nations, the Taliban has reneged on promises to grant certain rights to women and girls, including blocking girls from secondary education. The first of two special guests on this edition of the program is Rina Amiri. She is U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Women, Girls, and Human Rights in the Office of Global Women's Issues at the U.S. Department of State. VOA's Nike Ching spoke with Ms. Amiri at the State Department on April 25th to discuss the status of women and girls in Afghanistan. Nike Ching asked her to address the recent attacks on mosques and schools that had been carried out by the Taliban during the Holy Month of Ramadan.
First, we extend our deep condolences to the families that have suffered so immensely and that are suffering even more devastating losses right now. It's of huge concern to us. Right now, in the middle of Ramadan, and a time that is holy for Muslims throughout the world, that Afghan women and children and vulnerable populations are being targeted. It's inhumane, it's unjust, and it's unacceptable. The Taliban recognize that this is an issue that we take very seriously. We are particularly concerned about the situation of vulnerable populations, ethnic and religious groups that have been under increasing attack, and the situation of women and children, which are continuing to go in a very negative direction. The longer that this continues in this way without robust response from the Taliban, the greater the country is going to suffer more devastating consequences.
Despite repeated commitments by the Taliban to reopen secondary schools for girls by the end of March 2022, they reversed this decision. This reversal has elicited strong criticism from the international community, but the question remains how to hold the Taliban responsible for breaking their commitments to the Afghan community. Here is what Rina Amiri had to say.
The Taliban should emphatically be held accountable. The Taliban made commitments to the Afghan population and to the international community that they would open up girls' schools on March 23rd. They made the statement repeatedly, even a week before they reneged on their decision. They had said that they would open up girls' schools. This is a decision that has been made from the top. It's coming directly from the Taliban, and there's no excuse for it. It's unacceptable. It puts Afghanistan in a reverse position and makes the situation of not just Afghan women and girls, but the population, it puts them at risk of greater poverty, greater suffering, and greater instability. If you look at anywhere in the world, the greatest indicator of a country's ability to progress at an economic level in terms of peace, in terms of stability, is the degree to which women and girls are engaged, are allowed education, are allowed the opportunity to work and to contribute to the viability of their country. You cannot just completely take away the rights of 50% of the population and expect to have a better outcome.
Nike Ching then asked Rina Amiri to what she attributed the Taliban's equivocation on the question of education for girls, speculating that it might reflect internal rifts.
I cannot speak on behalf of where the Taliban stands on these issues, but what I can say is that the decision that they're making is bad for the country, it's bad for the Taliban as a group, and it's bad for the viability of a secure and stable Afghanistan.
Rina Amiri goes on to say that the international community would not release frozen funds to the Taliban regime until their actions matched their words.
The Taliban understand, they not only in the last 6-7 months, but for the last several years, what has been made very clear to the Taliban is that they have to deliver on their commitments. They cannot just deliver on in terms of rhetoric. They have to implement on concrete deliverables to the Afghan population, including getting girls the right to school, the right to work, and to create a culture of hope rather than a culture of repression. The direction that they're taking the country by these decisions is one that's going to lead to greater instability, greater conflict, greater migration, a greater brain drain. It's all a direction that's going to take Afghanistan on an even more negative course.
In early March, the State Department awarded 12 women the International Women of Courage Awards. An Afghan woman was not among the recipients of the awards. Rina Amiri pushes back against criticism of the State Department for not including an Afghan woman among the awardees and emphasizes the work of the department that has prioritized Afghan women and girls.
I think that there's collective recognition, not just by the U.S., but globally, that Afghan women are the bravest women in the world. The level of challenges that they're facing, the adversity that they have faced, the fact that their rights have been reversed overnight. And quite honestly, I think what I understand in terms of the deliberations is that it was very hard to come back and say we're going to pick one woman out of, you know, the hundreds of thousands of brave Afghan women. I think the understanding is that every Afghan woman is a leader, a woman of courage. The International Women of Courage Award is an incredibly important effort in terms of recognizing a woman leader, but there are other efforts underway as well. For example, the establishment of my office, having a special envoy for women, girls, and human rights, not just my position, but establishing an office that's resourced, that's staffed, and that is completely dedicating to leveraging the voices of Afghan women. That is what we put on the table as something that needed to be in place given the gravity of the challenges that Afghan women face.
Amiri reminds us that everything changed overnight on August 15, 2021, when the Taliban took over in Kabul. The lack of a U.S. embassy, she tells Nike Ching, is a drawback, preventing Washington and her office in particular from doing as much as they would like to support Afghan women.
There were a host of different challenges, and that certainly was one of them. The situation changed overnight on August 15th. And, you know, all of the efforts that were underway inside the country, there was a fundamental reorientation that had to be done in terms of how do you support Afghan women and girls? How do you leverage them? How do you engage both the women inside the country and those that have been recently exiled? In many respects, I think that the level of support has increased in many ways. My office is one of the few that is specifically focused on one country that is focused on women and girls.
Rina Amiri is the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Women, Girls, and Human Rights in the Office of Global Women's Issues at the U.S. Department of State. She spoke with VOA's Nike Ching on April 25th. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to all our loyal Afghan listeners, and we hope you can hear us. If you want to make a comment on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com, or as always, like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We now turn to one of the foremost experts on South Asia and Afghanistan in particular, Michael Kugelman. He's Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. That's a think tank based in Washington. And Michael, as you know, is no stranger to the VOA microphones. He is a valued and frequent panelist on Encounter. And Michael Kugelman joins us now on Press Conference USA via Microsoft Teams. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, Michael, we just heard Rina Amiri talking about the devastating situation of women and girls in Afghanistan under the Taliban. But let's go back and get your general assessment about how Afghanistan now has changed over the last 8 months since the Taliban takeover and the U.S. departure last August.
So unfortunately, it's changed considerably and really for the worse on the whole. This is not to say that things were perfect or anything close to that before the U.S. forces had left and before the Taliban had taken over. But you know, I think what stands out the most in terms of what's changed over the last 8 months are an economic crisis that had been present for quite some time, but that had intensified in a big way after the Taliban takeover, in great part because of the sanctions that were imposed by the West. Afghanistan had long been a country dependent on international assistance. So with the sanctions in place, that means that you don't really have much money coming into the country at all. And the Taliban is a group that, of course, has no experience leading a country, leading a government. It has no experience with policymaking. It has no experience with addressing an economic crisis that would be difficult for even the most experienced of governments. And so as a result, we've had this incredibly tragic humanitarian and broader economic crisis playing out over the last 8 months. Another big change that we've had is an upsurge in terrorist attacks by the Islamic State group. It's been around for many years, but the Taliban takeover really emboldened Islamic State. It sees the Taliban as a rival, and it has wanted to do everything it can to make the Taliban look bad. And Islamic State has targeted the Taliban. It's also targeted so many civilians, killed so many civilians. And so unfortunately, you know, for the long-suffering Afghan people, over the last 8 months, they've had to deal with not only this terrible economic crisis, but also this increased threat posed by terrorism.
And we note this week, Michael, that there were heavy rains and flooding that killed approximately 22 people, according to Reuters, destroyed hundreds of homes and damaged crops in Afghanistan, which, as you say, is already facing a humanitarian crisis. The Taliban government, which, as you said, also doesn't have much experience, is struggling to cope with the disaster that has affected more than a third of its provinces. How much more of a problem and how much more does this exacerbate the already horrific humanitarian situation?
If you want to look for a silver lining here, one of Afghanistan's many serious challenges in recent months has been a drought. There had been one of the worst droughts Afghanistan has had in many years playing out over the last few months. And Afghanistan is a very climate change vulnerable country, among other things. So there had been this long drought that had affected agricultural productivity. So I guess on the one hand, it's good to finally be getting all this rain, but unfortunately, it's been coming through intense rain and floods. And you know, this is one more case of the Taliban regime being confronted with a problem, with a policy emergency that it lacks the experience, the capacity, and the resources to deal with. Unfortunately, I don't think that Afghans can depend on their Taliban government to ease this crisis or ease this new crisis, this new emergency anytime soon.
In terms of revenues and foreign aid, Michael Kugelman, paint us a picture of what kind of assistance is coming in and through what channels are salaries being paid? Describe for us the overall picture.
Really, the only type of financial assistance that's coming into Afghanistan now is humanitarian support. And that essentially entails food aid, food shipments. A lot of sacks of wheat have been coming into the country, for example, and other immediate term assistance that is distributed via UN agencies based in Afghanistan, like the World Food Program. That humanitarian aid is also going to charitable organizations functioning in Afghanistan. So there has not been money going to the Taliban regime, and that's because of the sanctions. So you know, you don't have any Western governments that are willing to put money directly in the hands of the Taliban. Now, countries in the region, regional players like Pakistan and some other countries, have been more inclined to support the idea of delivering money directly to the Taliban regime. But so far as I know, there hasn't been any type of effort to mobilize that type of assistance anytime soon. Now, there have been some efforts on the part of the U.S. government to try to carve out exceptions to the sanctions regime on the Taliban so that there could be more opportunities to bring money to Afghanistan that go beyond mere humanitarian assistance. Because I mean, just to provide you with a picture of how serious the economic crisis is, banks barely have any money in Afghanistan right now. So no one can get paid, certainly within the government, but beyond that as well. So there's a liquidity crisis, among other things. There's just not enough cash in the country. So the U.S. government has been trying to carve out exceptions to the sanctions regime to allow there to be some possibilities to bring some money to certain sectors of the government so that, for example, the education ministry can pay teachers, so that health components of the government can bring payments, resources, salaries to doctors and nurses. But unfortunately, this has not gotten as far as many would like it to get. And the big problem here is that many of the Western and the foreign banks that would be delivering this assistance, they're very risk averse. They really worry about doing something that could cause them to run afoul of the sanctions regime. So that's really slowed things down. Final point here is that, you know, as you know, the war in Ukraine has become the big focus for the U.S. and most governments in the West and in Europe. These are the key donors to Afghanistan. And so they've been distracted in a big way. And so, you know, the relatively little bandwidth and policy space that had been allocated to helping Afghanistan, it's shrunk to a considerable degree with this justified and understandable heightened focus on Ukraine. So I think that means some of the momentum we had been seeing from the U.S. government to try to find ways to expand assistance to Afghanistan beyond humanitarian aid, that momentum has really slowed down, unfortunately.
With regard to the economic crisis, many experts say Afghanistan has a potentially lucrative agricultural sector. It has a young and growing population that could help the economy recover. But do you see the Taliban exploiting those advantages, capitalize on the assets that Afghanistan has?
Yeah, it's a good question. But unfortunately, Afghanistan is in too much of a deep crisis for the Taliban regime or anyone in Afghanistan right now to be able to take advantages of those opportunities that you describe, the potential for more agricultural productivity, the potential for harnessing the capacities of a very large, young, working age population. It's just not realistic now because, again, there's no money in the country. There's a liquidity crisis. You've got millions on the verge of starvation. So unfortunately, it'd be a luxury to be thinking about how to capitalize on potential opportunities to strengthen economic growth. The Taliban lacks the capacity to address this type of huge economic crisis that even the most experienced government would struggle to address. And so as a result, what we're seeing, I mean, perhaps by default, is that the Taliban is quietly encouraging illicit economic sectors in Afghanistan. Now, the Taliban made a big deal soon after it took power by saying that it was going to ban the narcotics trade. It was going to ban poppy production. As you know, drugs have long been a major economic moneymaker in Afghanistan. The Taliban said it was going to do away with that. That has not happened at all. And I would actually argue that the Taliban will have a strong incentive to really encourage drug production because it's one of the few sectors that has the capacity to grow and deliver revenue even now. And obviously that causes other problems and other challenges. So no, I don't see there being any type of way to capitalize on these opportunities. Another opportunity, I'm not sure if you mentioned this one, is the mineral reserves that Afghanistan has. Most of these mineral reserves are unexploited. No one's ever been able to try to get to them because of technological, financial, security concerns. At this point, that's not an option either. Some have said that China may be a candidate to come in and try to exploit that type of wealth. But even the likes of China being very cautious about doing anything in Afghanistan, given its very volatile, uncertain state right now.
Speaking of China, anything to add with regard to China's posture toward Afghanistan?
It's interesting that soon after the Taliban took over, many critics of the U.S. military withdrawal had said, well, look, the Taliban's in power, the U.S. is gone. It's only a matter of time before China steps in and fills the vacuum left by the U.S. departure. And, you know, look out, China's going to become a big player in Afghanistan, which works against U.S. interests. And I'd always thought that narrative was a bit flawed. Yes, China is very interested potentially in developing a deeper footprint in Afghanistan, particularly through investment. I mean, as you know, China has this Belt and Road Initiative, which is this huge global infrastructure initiative. It wants to bring that into Afghanistan. It wants to invest in Afghanistan. China has not been a major economic player in Afghanistan for the last 20 years because of the war. Now that the war is over, it has an opportunity, but Beijing has continued to be very cautious. It's going to take a wait and watch approach. It has not committed much financial assistance at all, even on the humanitarian assistance front. What it has put out there is much less than what many other bilateral actors from the U.S. to Japan have offered. But I think the big issue for China is the security situation. China is not going to want to get its feet wet in Taliban-led Afghanistan until it is reassured, first of all, that the Taliban is going to stick around, it's going to be able to consolidate power. And second, China is going to want to receive assurances that the Taliban is targeting the terrorist groups that worry China, one of them being Islamic State, the other being the ETIM, this group of Uyghur militants that China worries about. I think China exaggerates the threat posed by that group. But until it sees the Taliban trying to curb these threats, It's going to continue to be cautious. It's going to be an observer for quite some time. I think that's the best way to describe its status for now.
Let's take a look at Russia. To what extent does Russia play a role? And if so, how has Moscow's invasion of Ukraine affected its posture toward Afghanistan?
You know, it's interesting because of the recent history of the Russian experiences in Afghanistan. It had been very cautious and not really involved or active in Afghanistan over the course of the U.S. military presence in the country. But in more recent years, and especially during the last few years of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, Russia, I mean, presumably anticipating the inevitability of the U.S. withdrawal, had started to engage more, not just with the Afghan government, but also with Taliban leaders, as well as other political figures that were not sitting in government. It started engaging with certain Afghan parliamentarians. So I think that Russia had been setting the stage for some type of stepped-up role in the country, which makes sense because Russia sees itself as maintaining this broader sphere of influence that includes enjoying significant levels of influence over the Central Asian states, which border Afghanistan. So it makes sense that Russia would want to have some type of presence in Afghanistan. And Russia also, it really worries about Islamic State, particularly because the Islamic State branch in Afghanistan has been able to recruit some jihadists from the Central Asian states. And that really worries Russia because of the direct threat it faced from them. But indeed, now with the war in Ukraine, I think that's going to really limit Russia's options. And if Russia were entertaining any desire to explore investment options in Afghanistan, I don't think that's going to happen now. Not because the Taliban wouldn't want Russian money. Taliban doesn't care about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But I think that the issue for Russia is that it wouldn't be in the financial position to start thinking about risky, uncertain investments in volatile spaces like Afghanistan. So Russia, I think diplomatically, will continue to be a key player on the Afghanistan front. For quite some time, there's been this what's known as a troika group comprised of Russia, China, and Pakistan, in which these countries meet to discuss Afghanistan. That may continue, though not with the U.S., but I really don't think that we're going to see Russia trying to invest in Afghanistan or really do much of anything else in Afghanistan anytime soon.
Let me ask you very quickly with respect to ISIS, the so-called ISIS-K. Have we seen a resurgence in ISIS terror in recent weeks in Afghanistan? And if so, how is the Taliban reacting or trying to combat that? Because that's an enemy. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So indeed, ISIS terror has resurged in Afghanistan in recent weeks. You know, there was that horrible attack outside the Kabul airport in August. But after that, for some months, there were some attacks, but not that many by ISIS. And some observers wrongly took that to mean that ISIS was losing clout. But no, ISIS was just recalibrating. And indeed, we've seen a rapid fire flurry of ISIS attacks over the last few weeks. So the Taliban has continuously downplayed the threat posed by ISIS. It continues to say it has the threat under control. But in reality, the Taliban is concerned about it. The Taliban has boasted of having arrested several ISIS leaders in Afghanistan. And the Taliban have also been conducting counterterrorism operations in Afghanistan against ISIS. But they've been very ineffective because they've been very indiscriminate. They've used scorched earth tactics that have ended up killing a lot of civilians. And as a result, the Taliban has ended up alienating local communities, which at the end of the day will benefit ISIS. And you know, the Taliban is at a disadvantage in its efforts to try to curb the ISIS threat because it doesn't receive the types of support that it used to when you had NATO forces in the country raining down airstrikes on ISIS. NATO forces are gone. The Taliban does not know how to operate air power. The Taliban, of course, is also so busy with all of these other challenges that it didn't have to worry about when it was just an insurgent group, when it would fight ISIS on the battlefield all the time. And indeed, I mean, the Taliban is a rival of ISIS, so it's going to want to go after it, but it's going to be very difficult. And I really don't think it has the capacity at this point to blunt this threat.
How about Pakistan, Michael Kugelman? They seem to be rejoicing when the Taliban took over or celebrating. How do they feel now about the Taliban in their neighbor Afghanistan?
Well, I think that indeed many Islamabad saw the Taliban takeover as an opportunity in the sense that for strategic reasons, Pakistan has long wanted there to be a friendly government leading Afghanistan. And it saw the Taliban as a friendly government because indeed the Taliban and Pakistan had been close, with Pakistan providing sanctuary to Taliban leadership, as well as providing medical facilities and other assistance to Taliban fighters in Pakistan. And indeed, Imran Khan, when he was prime minister, very famously said that the Afghan people had removed the shackles of slavery when the Taliban took over. But yeah, I think that we're seeing Pakistan receive a rude awakening. Buyer's remorse, however you want to call it, its former asset has not been getting along well with Pakistan. We've had some cases of Pakistani troops trying to fence the border with Afghanistan in recent weeks. And the Taliban, like other previous Afghan governments in power since the Pakistani state was established, have rejected that border. Taliban leaders have been virulently criticizing the Pakistani state, which never would have happened in the past. This is because the Taliban is trying to assert its independence from its former patron. All that said, Pakistan wants things to work with the Taliban regime. It's going to continue to do what the Imran Khan government had done when it was in power, which is to prop up the Taliban and try to convince the world to deliver more assistance to Afghanistan and directly to the Taliban government. Why is that? Well, no Pakistani state wants to see a collapsed or failed state in Afghanistan because of the implications of that, to heighten refugee flows, cross-border terrorism, instability. Pakistan is already dealing with the threat, perceived threat from India on its other border. It doesn't want to have to be concerned about what's happening in Afghanistan. But the other issue for Pakistan is its concern about the Pakistan Taliban terror group, which has been scaling up its attacks in Pakistan, just like ISIS has been scaling up its attacks in Afghanistan. The Pakistani Taliban is based in Afghanistan. Pakistan had hoped that the Taliban in Afghanistan would curb or expel the Pakistan Taliban presence in Afghanistan. It has not done that because the Taliban in Afghanistan is closely allied with the Pakistan Taliban. This has added to tensions between Pakistan and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and it's really caused a lot of concern for Pakistan to the point that in recent weeks we've seen a few cases of Pakistani military operations across the border in Afghanistan targeting the Pakistan Taliban, which of course has not made the Taliban happy.
Very quickly, with regard to the Taliban's performance or lack thereof in government, Michael, what accounts for the retrogressive policies, particularly the non-inclusive government with respect to other ethnic and religious minorities, harsh restrictions on women? What can you say about any rifts within the movement?
Yeah, this is a critical point. And I think it's one of the biggest storylines to emerge from Afghanistan in recent weeks, the fact that we're seeing a series of retrogressive policies, which really are just like the Taliban policies in the late 90s. And indeed, the fact that the Taliban did not keep its promise to reopen schools to older girls, that's a huge blow. And it's also a huge blow, I think, in terms of getting more humanitarian aid into the country, because you're going to have many governments in the West that are simply so disgusted with that decision that they are not going to want to do anything to bring more money to Afghanistan, even if it's meant to help the Afghan people. Why are we seeing all these retrogressive policies? I think it's really an indication that the hardliners within the Taliban have won their internal battles, institutional battles with the more moderate factions of the Taliban. I mean, we know that it's the hardliners that are in power now. They control the ministries. They are the ministers right now. Whereas the moderates, they've been relegated to deputy roles or no roles at all. And, you know, indeed, it's been the moderates that have been trying to make the argument within the organization that the ideology has to be moderated or scaled back if there's to be any chance of Afghanistan getting the financial support that it really needs. But the hardliners reject that idea. And for them, ideology is everything. And they don't care about getting international recognition or international legitimacy. So as a result, you know, we've seen what we've seen in recent weeks. And I fear that we're going to see a lot more of it just because the hardliners seem to be very comfortably in control right now and don't seem to face any type of threat from within the Taliban, from the more moderate factions.
Well, Michael, as we close, how would you characterize U.S. policy in Afghanistan now, and what is your assessment of it?
Well, it's disappointing. I know that U.S. goals in Afghanistan have had to be reduced since the U.S. departure, and I supported that U.S. departure, I should say. But I feel that so much more could have been done on the humanitarian assistance front. So much more could have been done to try to think through in a very careful, deep interagency fashion, how can we get more money into Afghanistan that goes beyond humanitarian assistance, especially because it was the U.S. sanctions on the Taliban regime which have exacerbated this economic crisis, this horrible economic crisis. It can be blamed to some degree on the U.S., even if one wants to agree that sanctions were the right policy. I think the onus is on the U.S. government in particular to take the lead in doing more to address this economic crisis.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson and center. Michael, as always, thank you so much for your critical insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with production assistance from Emma Wilcox and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.